Welcome to Clinical Pearls. I'm Tracy White. I'm here with my co-host, BJ Hamankuli. BJ, hello.
Hey,
hello.
Tracy.
Nice to see you. Today we're talking with Dr. Amy Yerdon. Mm-hmm. She's a CRNA. We're going to be talking about hypotension or low blood pressure, specifically in the operating room.
Yeah, that's a very good topic. Tracy, you are an OR nurse, right?
Mm-hmm.
How often did you deal with low blood pressure in the OR?
Well, to be honest, luckily my colleagues like Amy and other anesthesiologists and nurse anesthetists managed that for us. Mm-hmm. So I was on the other side of that curtain. And when everything went well, I didn't know they had hypotension.
Mm-hmm.
But as we've learned from her, there's important things to consider, even if they are managing it, how they're being managed, and that communication with the surgery team, and even postoperatively, these episodes of low blood pressure really carry forth even after the patient leaves the operating room. So I'm really excited to talk to her. I think we learned a lot.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. And I think that the take-home message to that is just making sure that everybody's aware that it happens,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. So tune in. We're excited about this conversation on Clinical Pearls. And remember to like and share on whatever platform you use to listen to podcasts. Low blood pressure during surgery is common in patients having non-cardiac surgery under general anesthesia, and this can be secondary to many factors, but it has been linked to major post-operative complications like renal failure, heart failure, and even death. And this is why on today's episode of Clinical Pearls, we have an expert in this field. Dr. Amy Yerdon is an assistant professor here at the UAB School of Nursing and is the BSN to DNP Nurse Anesthesia Assistant Program Director. She is passionate about educating other anesthesia providers about intraoperative hypotension and the risk for postoperative patient complications. She is focused on raising awareness of this problem and educating others on the current evidence for appropriate intraoperative hemodynamic management. Amy, it's really good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I was honored to be asked, so it's good to be here.
Good. Well, can you start by telling us a little bit about the role of a certified registered nurse anesthetist, or CRNAs, and the preparation that one needs to have to become one?
Sure. So CRNAs are advanced practice RNs. We start out as RNs. We have to have a bachelor's degree, at least 1 year minimum critical care experience, but the average, I believe, now is around 2 to 3 by the time people start a program. To really build on that, taking care of critically ill patients, high acuity patients, and learn vasopressor management and ventilator management and all of that. And then it's most places are 3 years. There are some 4-year programs. We have a 3-year program here at UAB. It's a doctoral program. And then nurse anesthetists are, they're the main anesthesia providers in the military. I don't know if a lot of people knew that. Yeah, and 80% of rural counties are anesthesia provided solely by CRNAs. But we can work in labor and delivery, doing obstetrics. We can work in pediatrics, providing sedation, general anesthesia, whatever patients need for procedures to keep them comfortable and keep them safe through the procedure. Pain management as well, endoscopy centers, pediatric or dentist's office, plastic surgeons' offices. We're kind of everywhere.
Yeah. Did this role start in the military?
It started nurses giving anesthesia on the battlefield in the Civil War.
Wow. Mm. Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow. So we're going to get personal here.
Okay.
What do you like about your role?
I love that I have a few minutes to talk to my patient and gain their trust. Because, you know, going under anesthesia, you feel very vulnerable. You're about to have surgery, but they feel very vulnerable and scared. So earning their trust and gaining their faith in me, and then talking to them and keeping them calm right before they go to sleep. And then I love the critical management of them intra-op. But then on the post-op side, you know, knowing maybe how much I could have struggled or not, depending on how they did, how they reacted to surgery, but that we deliver them safe in recovery room and tucked in and warm and pain-free, hopefully. And for them to like wake up and say, thank you. Like I love the whole thing of it. So
you really are the patient advocate and, mm-hmm. and their lifeline during that case.
Absolutely, because and surgeons are great. They do a fantastic sure. job, but their job is also to do a specific procedure. It's our job to say, not right now, or you need to stop, because we've got to, you know, we've got all that to take into consideration with what's going on with the patient.
Oh, yeah, they can't do their job without your part of it.
Right.
Or not very effectively anyway.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes you're the last person and the first person the patient sees mm-hmm. During that intraoperative process as well, as operative process as well. You know, what is intraoperative hypotension? That is a mouthful, so I am going to call it IOH.
Yes, thank you. Like the short answer is it's a blood pressure below which our end organs are not being perfused adequately. So that varies from person to person, but if we look at just the broad population, what we have found in the last probably 5-6 years, there's a lot of evidence coming out that a mean arterial pressure less than 65 is associated with postoperative negative outcomes for our patients, such as acute kidney injury, mortality, and myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery specifically. And then there's some other things that are popping up as well. We already knew about post-op nausea and vomiting, ileus, but now there's a lot of evidence on post-op cognitive dysfunction and delirium. Surgical site infections as well. So there's associations with intra-op hypotension and these negative outcomes. And we weren't aware of it before, we as anesthesia providers, because in a lot of places we don't get data on post-operative patient outcomes. So we drop our patients off in recovery, they look good, I go to my next case.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the story for me. So unless you have the opportunity to work in a facility where you do get to see those outcomes, and some mm-hmm. places do that, I've never had it where I work. I never get any of this data. So I have no idea that that's happening. So that's where a lot of this this recent evidence is just so fascinating. We had no idea that there is a problem. So that's what I'm trying to do, is raise awareness about that, number one.
Are you finding that now there is a connection, or who is that connection where now you're saying, oh, I do need to know what happened weeks after, months after, and how are you collecting that data?
There are some facilities that do that as part of, like, they have mandatory reporting mm-hmm.
yeah.
for CMS. So some places will do that and report that data back to the providers. But if you're not in a facility that must report independent metrics, they do it as a group, mm-hmm. it's done on your behalf, then you never see that. So then you never hear anything back. So, like in my facility where I work in North Alabama, they report as a group, and I'm this is not my area of expertise, so we never see that data. So we don't even know, other than talking to critical care,
mm-hmm.
The people that manage critical care management post-op, and they'll say, yeah, we do see a lot of AKI and a lot of ileus post-op. That's the only thing I hear. Yeah, anecdotal.
Yeah.
But it's all in the evidence now. A lot has come out. Like I said, it started about 5-6 years ago, but in the last 2 years, it's just really accelerated, the amount of literature coming out about it.
Interesting.
Well, you know, Tracy and I are both critical care trained NPs, so a patient having low blood pressure does not, you know, excite us too much.
We're actually more excited about a low than a high, probably.
Yeah, it doesn't excite us too much. But, you know, how common is IOH during surgery?
So it depends. There's so many definitions that are out there in the studies. I mentioned a mean arterial pressure less than 65. The duration of that has a big part to play in this. So I think we would all say, yeah, a mean less than 55, that's too low. And any amount of time below that threshold is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But less than 65, if I allow that to go longer, that's more of a problem. So that the longer the duration, the deeper the severity. So depth and duration are the two things that really play into increasing our patient risk for harm. So depending on how it's defined, the occurrence varies in the studies. The ones that use a mean arterial pressure less than 65 for 1 minute, that recurrence is like 88%, 90%
wow.
of patients having general anesthesia for non-cardiac surgery.
And 1 minute is not that long.
No, No. And the other thing is that it's cumulative. So if I have hypotension and it lasts for 1 to 2 minutes, I treat it and it comes up, I feel great about myself, right?
Yeah.
But then it happens again 10, 15 minutes later and I treat it and it only lasts 1 to 2 minutes. I feel proud that I'm only allowing it to happen 1 to 2 minutes. But that was 2, 4, 6, right? And it carries over into the immediate post-op period, which comes into play with what you were saying, post-op in the critical care area. That is also cumulative with this. So if we aren't doing a good job intra-op, we're setting the patient up, right, for negative outcomes in the PACU, in the ICU, and are we mentioning that in report? Like, hey, I struggled with intra-op hypotension, so therefore you on the post-op side need to make sure you stay on top of it so we don't keep adding those minutes in and increasing the risk of negative outcomes for the patient.
That's a good point that you bring up because I never thought about it that way, mm-hmm. that it's a cumulative effect. So
I don't think a lot of CRNAs did either. We think it was once, and it was only a couple minutes, and that was it. And that happened twice in trop. It wasn't that big of a deal.
Yeah.
But it is. It mm-hmm. all counts.
So mm-hmm. almost as if, not really even something I need to worry them with. It's fine. We've got it back to normal, and I'm going to drop them off, and they'll be fine. They
right.
You know, it's not even things that you would think about, oh, this is so important for you to know.
Right.
Yeah.
The other point is that the duration, right? So, for instance, if you're in a case that lasts 4 hours, God mm-hmm. forbid, and you
that's a lot of my cases.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I've been in cases that last.
Yeah.
So that, and you can imagine if a patient has had, you know, 1 minute increments of IOH, how that can, you know, affect the patient in a 4 hour case and also postoperatively. So that's a good point to remember.
May I give you some more information on that? There's I put together this table. I just gave a presentation at our conference this weekend, the UAB Nurse Anesthesia Update, and I put together a table of it was 5 or 6 different studies, and it looked at how IOH was defined by MAP, the duration, and then it had the cumulative minutes as well. And out of those 5 to 6 studies, they all use different definitions for duration. Mm-hmm. But the range of cumulative minutes was like 28 to 35 or so. So it's pretty significant.
Yeah.
And each of those studies were like over 20,000 patients in each study. Some of them were over 300,000. So, I mean, we're looking at a huge sample of patients. Cumulative hypotension is common.
So in the data would show that in that study, or those studies altogether, around 28 to 30 minutes, patients are experiencing this.
Cumulative IOH. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do they talk about, is that a case that's 1 hour, 4 hours, 10 hours? Do they discriminate against?
Some of them did. Now, some of them were, all of the cases were an average length of about 4 hours.
Okay.
There was one study that they looked at ambulatory surgery centers.
Wow.
So those are only 1, 2 hours tops. Yeah. So to have a cumulative time of 30 minutes, I mean, we're looking at a quarter to a half mm-hmm. of the surgical time. I mean, that's very significant.
Wow. So what causes it?
So I mean, that is a great question.
Which I'm sure. Yeah. What's the magical thing that causes
right.
it?
Right. Yeah. Well, I like to review this with my, I teach a lot of students clinically in the operating room, and I like to break it down. We know cardiac output, you know, leads to blood pressure, right? So what are the determinants of cardiac output? You've got heart rate times stroke volume.
Correct.
So heart rate, bradycardia, can mm-hmm. cause hypertension. So we always have to remember that that's one that's easy to forget. It might just be we need to raise their heart rate a little bit, and that will increase your cardiac output. But then your determinants of stroke volume, so preload, contractility, and afterload. And I really believe based on all
she's
of this.
Taking us through physiology.
I know. I love. Oh, I have such memories coming back.
Is it PTSD?
I started sweating a little bit, but
know,
that's awesome.
Right?
Continue. Sorry.
It really is helpful if you go through a stepwise approach mm-hmm. and address preload first. Is the problem hypovolemia? Do we need to give them some fluid first? Optimize their stroke volume that way. If that's not the case, then we move to contractility. And so give them an inotrope if that's what is needed. And then finally, vasopressors if they're vasodilated. So I mentioned bradycardia, myocardial depression, hypovolemia, vasodilation. And then you've got your mixed types, which that would be, it's several things going on at once. or even extrinsic factors like patient positioning, the surgical procedure itself, if we're putting pressure on the heart, then we just stop that thing if you can, which is not always easy to do intra-op, but it's definitely multifaceted.
You know, and in my population surgeries, it's those patients who are already coming into the OR, maybe septic or, you know, pre-septic, you know, with some kind of infection going on, which actually necessitates that surgical procedure. So you have to know how all that ties in into possibly causing IOH, right?
Yeah, I was going to say or ask along those lines, what is it, what is the effect of your patient condition when you come into the OR? So obviously that's different for everybody. A patient coming in for emergency surgery from the unit or from a tragic accident or something is a little different than me going in for an elective. But what can, what should clinicians know about that as we're sending patients to the OR? How do we optimize that, or what should we be looking out for, or maybe communicating with you as they're coming in?
Yeah, so it, when we're talking specifically about inpatients coming down to the OR, it, what I see clinically, anecdotally, is a lot of dehydration. So I do think it's possible we could do a better job of optimizing volume status beforehand, but that's my snapshot from where I work. I can't speak for everywhere, and I haven't really seen a lot in the literature about this, actually. But your patients that are septic are often coming already on vasopressors, and sometimes, you know, if we get them hooked up to our advanced hemodynamic monitors, we can see, okay, we've fixed the vasodilation, but they're still behind on volume. You know, so that's where just knowing the picture, and I myself, in my own experience, don't really have an issue with people not giving us good information. Sometimes it, if you're not doing the advanced hemodynamic monitoring in the unit or on the floor, they're definitely not on the floor, they don't know that they're behind on volume. So it's not something that that is, we're just missing intentionally, just don't have any idea until they get down to the operating room and we hook them up to our things and we're like, oh yeah, they're dry, we're behind.
You're behind before you even start.
Right.
And then we were being kind of harsh about the minute or 28 minutes, but trying to figure out what's going on might take a minute.
It does, yeah.
I mean, it does. You know, so many things. Where are we at? What are we given? You know, time is ticking.
Right, and then you've got the balance of, you know, we need, it's like a seesaw, right? You've got to balance how much anesthesia you give your patient for what is stimulating them. So if surgery hasn't started yet, we're waiting on the surgeon, we have zero stimulation. So you've really got to balance how much, and so we call it the valley of prep. Because it's during that prep time, we're just waiting. All we need is surgical stimulation. So that's a fine tightrope to watch, you know, to walk as well. I know if that surgeon will just come in here and start, the pressure's going to come right
up. That's right.
And they're right there. They're washing their hands. I see them. They're about to come in. But how many minutes is that? So that's very, it's really hard to decide in the moment, you know, do I treat it right now? Because he, you know, they might get caught in a conversation before they come in after they wash their hands. I don't know what's about to happen.
What did you call that?
Valley of Prep.
Valley of Prep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because we do know there are some anesthetic agents that will cause hypotension, right? But that's something that is expected, right?
Exactly. Yeah, they are very, very myocardial depressive, some of them.
Yeah. You know, I was in preparation for this topic, I was reading an article that stated that, you know, most treatment for IOH is often, you know, reactive, right? And it's stated that, you know, we need to train our clinicians to be more proactive, and stated some signs that we could be looking at, some subtle signs of potential IOH. What are some of those that you know of?
So I think, I don't know which article you're referring to specifically, but there's, we've got your advanced hemodynamic monitoring that gives you all the information you could use to help know where you're at in the moment and some things that are, you know, predicting IOH is coming. So you've got that field. And then you've got so many places that don't have access to that technology. So how do they do it? So I want to answer it from both sides, if you don't care.
Yeah.
That's great.
But without the technology, it's a lot harder, obviously. I you know, luckily get to work in a place where I have access to this technology, but I don't use it in every case because the cost associated with it might not be worth the benefit to different patients. So we reserve it for moderate to high-risk patients and or moderate to high-risk procedures. So your easier things, easier cases, and your healthier patients, it might not be the best option cost-wise to use the technology. So in those patients, if I wait for the heart rate to increase, we're behind the eight ball, right? That happens late in the game. You may not see any blood pressure or heart rate change until we have like a 20% drop in their volume status.
Oh, wow.
It's very late. Can't rely on urine output because surgical stimulation causes a excretion of antidiuretic hormone.
Mm-hmm.
CVP is more of an indication of the pressure in the right atrium, not so much volume status. So those are all our traditional endpoints. So instead, what I tend to look, if I don't have the technology, I look at the variability in my pulse ox waveform.
Oh.
Because when they're on they're on a ventilator, they get positive pressure ventilation. Mm-hmm. That increases our intrathoracic pressure,
correct,
compresses the vena cava, reduces venous return to the heart. So you see an overall reduction in stroke volume at end expiration. That is more significant if they're hypovolemic. So that variation in stroke volume in relation to the positive pressure breaths,
mm-hmm,
you'll see it on their pulse ox because it's perfusion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Distal perfusion. So you can see this great variation if they're hypovolemic. I can see that sometimes before they get hypotensive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I have the technology, it's amazing because it'll give you your cardiac output, cardiac index, stroke volume variation, which is giving you a number that's a percentage change from baseline. So it's the same thing we saw on the pulse ox waveform, right? It's just giving you an actual number to quantify it. How much are we changing from baseline?
Mm-hmm.
And we know the more hypovolemic they are, the more change you're going to see. So that higher that number goes, they're dry. So
yeah,
we say high is dry.
Yeah.
So we can see that change before they get hypotensive as well. So you can go ahead and give some fluid based on that. You can see the cardiac index starting to decline. You could treat that beforehand. And then the best option is if you have this other technology called the hypotension prediction index. It's a unitless number on a scale from 0 to 100. And it detects instability in the cardiovascular system. And not only that, so it's telling you hypotension is going to happen. The higher that number goes, the more probable it will happen for sure, and the sooner it's going to happen. So a number like 85,
mm-hmm,
it's going to happen in about 5 or 6 minutes. And then you get this secondary information about why it's going to happen. Is it preload, contractility, or afterload?
Mm-hmm.
A lower number, like say 40, 45, it may or may not happen, but it's going to be like 15 minutes down the road.
Gotcha.
So it's not as big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
So those early warning alerts basically tell you what is happening right now. And if I don't treat it, we're going to get hypotensive. And I've gotten to use some of that equipment in our facility where I work clinically. And it's a game changer.
Wow,
to actually prevent hypotension. It's it's like magic.
Yeah, it really does seem like that.
Yeah.
So, the authors of this article actually stated exactly what you just told us, but they also talked about some of those subtle things like low heart rate,
mm-hmm,
decreased urine output. So if a patient has been inpatient and their urine output has been drastically decreasing through a shift,
mm-hmm,
that's some of those subtle things that, they're advising us to look out for.
Yes.
Yeah.
This may sound like a very basic question and not any relation at all, but is there a relationship between someone who normally runs low, their normal blood pressure is a little bit low, but they're healthy, and having these episodes of intraoperative hypertension? I mean, do you run them at about what their normal blood pressure should be, or do you try to raise it a little bit during the case, or I'm sure it's individualized, but...
Yeah, that's a great answer to a great question.
I
yes.
just answered my own question.
Yes.
I was just taking a guess and
trying
to see if I knew anything.
Individualized care is the best case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would venture to guess that almost every single CRNA right now practicing learned that we should keep our patient's intra-op blood pressure or MAP within 20% of normal.
Okay.
Now, the problem with that, or the challenge with that, is what is their normal? How do I find out what their normal is? Is it a documented preoperative blood pressure? Is it the first one when they got to the hospital? Is it the first one in the OR? Anxiety plays a part in all of those, and that it can jack that number up. So now what do I rely on? So this study, it was like 2017, Salmasi was the main author on that one. They sought to look at that specifically. We all learned keep a MAP within 20% of pre-op. But what if we look at an absolute threshold of MAP less than different, you know, thresholds? And they found that those two indicators, or those two thresholds, they were neither was more likely to predict AKI or cardiac injury. So if there is no difference, then why not use a solid number that's easier to go by? I can use that no matter what on every person, MAP less than 65. Now, what you said about if I have naturally lower blood pressure, I'm not going to drive their blood pressure up. But I got to know that this is, you know, this is normal for them. Then I should be keeping them, you know, close to normal for them.
Okay.
But if I don't know, then the easiest, safest thing is MAP less than 65 is considered too low.
Got it.
So how do you treat IOH when you encounter it in the OR?
So I do a lot of major abdominal surgery. So for those kinds of cases, it's a moderate to high risk procedure. I get to use the technology, right? So I have the benefit of having additional information to help make my clinical decisions. So I do that stepwise approach that I mentioned earlier, and it's a little algorithm: fill, flow, pressure. So fill, I address preload first, optimize stroke volume first. Because there is some recent stuff, that I think it was in 2022, a study that came out, they looked at fluids, vasopressors, and the associated AKI over like a four-year period, 2015 to 2019. And they used the MPOG database, if y'all are familiar with that, the Michigan Perioperative Group. Tons of facilities in this country, they get data. So they looked at like 22,000 patients in that study. And they found that over that four-year period, we, as an anesthesia, administered less intra-op fluids, we gave more vasopressors, we had less hypotension, probably because we were giving more vasopressors, and we had more acute kidney injury.
Oh, wow.
So we're probably picking the wrong treatment. We are looking at the number on the monitor and saying, there's hypotension, give a vasopressor, rather than fixing the cause of the hypotension. So that's why if you do fill, flow, pressure, you're addressing the most likely causes of the hypotension rather than putting a Band-Aid on it with a vasodilator and causing iatrogenic harm. So fill, you know, optimize your stroke volume. Flow is talking about perfusion to the end organs through contractility. So address my cardiac index. And I'll give ephedrine is my go-to, but if their heart rate's on the higher end, I don't want to push it up higher, I may go straight to calcium, whether I know their calcium level or not, because it has such a great inotropic effect without really, you know, having a bad effect on their calcium level. Epi would be a third line for me. There are some places that are going straight to norepi because you get that beta along with alpha. And then finally, the fill flow pressure, then I address vasodilation, give a vasopressor for that. So being very intentional with treating the cause, not just trying to fix a number with a Band-Aid.
So when you give, so the first one fill, so you give more fluid.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you wait? Because again, we're on that time crunch.
Mm-hmm.
So how long does it take to correct it? Mm-hmm. If the fill is the problem, right, when would you see a result? Is it within seconds?
No, it's going to take a couple minutes for that volume to get in, depending on, you know, size IV, all those things. I like to go with albumin as my fluid bolus because it stays intravascular longer. It has this protective effect of the glycocalyx, which is that blood-body barrier. It's how we lose fluid to the interstitium if that's damaged.
Mm-hmm.
We can damage it with aggressive fluid resuscitation. Mm-hmm. So albumin, it helps protect that, so it stays intravascular. And then if I can get that in within 5 to 10 minutes, I should see, you know, a 10% increase in their stroke volume. That tells me they were fluid responsive. Now, I don't like to let them be hypotensive during that time, 5 to 10 minutes. We keep talking about cumulative time. So probably go ahead and give them some ephedrine or some phenylephrine to treat the blood pressure so I'm not sitting hypotensive while I'm fixing the cause.
Oh, yeah.
But if I get on it quick enough, I can get the volume in sometimes before they get too hypotensive. Mm-hmm. Depends on when I caught it.
Got it.
And if I'm behind and they're already hypotensive, I do albumin and either ephedrine or phenylephrine.
So that makes sense. Amy, this question is for me.
Mm-hmm.
I need for you to help me. I cannot tell you how many times I've gotten a patient from the OR into my ICU, and I see LR hanging out there, lactate O-ringers.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you guys hang so much LR?
That's so funny.
You've been waiting for this question.
It's just for my
so benefit. Personal.
Yeah.
It's a burn in his belly.
Mm-hmm.
Because the studies show us that intra-op isotonic balanced crystalloid is what we should be using. And if we go with normal saline, that increases the risk of hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis and renal dysfunction, actually. So we stick more with Normosol, Plasmolite, LR. LR is easiest to come by, so that's usually what we do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is for all my ICU clinicians out there. That's why.
That's why.
You see a lot of LR hanging.
They have a reason.
Yeah, they have a reason.
Yeah.
Well, thank you,
Amy. You're welcome.
Well, I think, surprisingly, we're about out of time again. We're always surprised at the end because we have such interesting guests, and you've just been a delight. This is such an interesting topic. I say that every single time, but they all are. We would love to know, what would be your take-home message from this episode today?
If our CRNAs listening out there and our nurse anesthesia students, hopefully they're listening too, that we should care because patients are experiencing negative outcomes. So we need to educate ourselves on that, why it's important, and then what we can do intra-op to help minimize that for our patients. And that, you know, AKI and myocardial injury is a big deal. And there's, you know, that's a whole other lecture in itself on why does even a stage 1 AKI affect our patients. So the fact is that they are experiencing bad outcomes, and we should be doing our very best intra-op to help prevent that.
Awesome.
I do want to add to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
It was something we were talking about when you first came down. The communication between y'all when you drop them off, and how important that is about what went on in the OR for your patients.
Right. So are you talking about because of the cumulative hypotension?
Well, and that
just
you did struggle
off.
A little bit.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid to tell.
Yeah. So this is the next step that I'm really wanting to look into more is post-op hypotension, mm-hmm. and the link between intra-op and post-op hypotension. And there's one study that I read that does say post-op hypotension is bad, especially if they had intra-op. So if we experienced, you know, that intra-op, we should be telling our PACU nurses and our ICU nurses and our providers about it so that they're more, you know, on top of it and not mm-hmm. so tolerant of it. Not that you would be, but it means more. If we know, if I tell you, hey, we had quite a bit of hypotension, then maybe you'll be a little more likely to stay on top of it, I guess, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Amy, thank you very much for joining us. And to all our listeners, we certainly do hope you found this session very informative. And remember to like and share from wherever you listen to podcasts. And we'll see you guys at the next episode.